have so many different things going on in my head right now. It's really hard to pinpoint what I want to ask you about. But I think I want to ask you about the visual
right.
and how it plays into this. I was struck by the, and really love the kind of gothic nature of knowledge that you delineated at the end.
Yeah.
It's kind of the embrace of knowing and not knowing.
Right.
Right? And I'm thinking about the air pump here because that's a way to envision
right.
something that is
there. Yeah.
And I was thinking then about what you were saying about the descriptions in Radcliffe that look like French painting but are drawn
right.
by English poetry.
Yes.
And so we know that they're not French.
Right.
And we also know that they're not painting. We know that they're global.
Right.
And I was also thinking about Priestley's embrace of language as something that is not oral.
Right.
That is visual.
Visual.
Right?
Right.
So
right.
I'm just trying to figure out how this all fits into a question, but I'm really interested in the kind of relationship of the visual to
yes.
the verbal here.
Yes.
The verbal print, you emphasize that a lot as
yes.
itself a kind of visual form that
yeah.
evokes something beyond itself.
Right.
That we can envision,
right.
that we can hear.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, maybe this is about not being able to fully know what atmosphere is. We don't really see it.
Right.
The way
exactly.
we see a painting,
yes.
the way we see the air pump.
Right. You can't. And even though, I mean, one of the techniques within like we should finish.
No, I think
okay.
I'm done.
Okay.
So I'm
yes.
kind of curious about that verbal
yeah.
visual tension
yes.
in your argument and how
yeah.
that works.
You know, that's a great question. And you're also pressing on what is, I think, a real problem actually in the later parts of the paper, because, you know, part of what I want to say about what writing did for Priestley was it really did make this invisible thing visible. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it really was, you know, it was this controlling compositional form and the visual dimension was really important because it moved him out of the, and so he's out of that risk and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
But it also shows limitations, so it has this kind of other
yeah.
side to it. So there's that kind of duality really going on here. But I think one of the things that I would say has to do with the peculiar nature of the visual field of writing. I mean, just stating the obvious, but still, which yes, you do have a visual field. It is making you see things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not actually literally picturing anything. If anything, the only thing it's really picturing is in that air, right? I mean, sounds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's really all you're seeing if you're seeing anything in a visual field of writing. And it's been sort of translated into that. So I think that writing as a visual medium has a very special sort of intermediate status between, you know, between invisible and visible forms of communication. I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, that sort of the whole apparition narrative phenomenon in the period, you know, is a way of sort of talking about writing. Right, as,
mm-hmm.
because apparitions are also in this intermediate relationship between the visible and the invisible world. So, you know, writing about them could work as in a kind of self-reflexive mode to talk about that particular action. But I do have to say, in honesty, you know, I think I don't feel completely comfortable with what I'm saying about, you know, what writing did for Priestley here, and it's precisely partly because of this whole question of, you know, what is the status of the visual. I mean, there's so much work in our field, you know, which is really undercutting the ocular obsession of the Enlightenment and the,
mm-hmm.
you know, the spectatorial eye-based forms of knowledge. And there's a part of me that wants to redeem that, right? And say
mm-hmm.
that you don't have to give up the visual entirely in order to accommodate other forms of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's been so much emphasis, and Eric, of course, gets into it on, you know, smells, right? Or sounds, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, Schmidt's book on hearing things is
mm-hmm.
that form of knowledge being very much, you know, the oral medium, the visual represses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or Corbin's book, The Fragment and the Foul, on, you know, olfactory knowledge
mm-hmm.
in the period in France, but which again is making the same kind of move and saying, you know, we just need to get rid of that visual image. But I don't think we necessarily do. I just
mm-hmm.
think we need to think, or at least I'm not, we, I'm not speaking that grandiosely, but I think some of these writers are conceptions of vision, and that would actually bring in some of the supernatural stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of, you know, what it means to see an apparition what versus what it means to see a physical object,
mm-hmm.
and what it means to, you know, see through a medium as opposed to just be looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But it's not, I have obviously not as fully as I would like.
No,
so.
I don't think it's incredibly suggestive. I think it's very
good.
Yeah. There's a question, maybe it's a 1590s answer to Barbara, but just to understand the literal sense, that bird that's not going to come out well in that.
No.
And what they're showing there is vacuum. Yes.
They're trying to.
Yeah.
That's the experiment. Yeah.
I mean, so if it were the 1590s,
yes,
the answer to Barbara's question back to radicalism,
right,
would mean that the world, the universe, isn't a plenum.
Right.
There can be empty spaces, and if there can be empty spaces, there can be a kind of radical movement, because not everything has to be filled, and therefore, in some sense, you know, there, even in a container that's filled, things can move around, but it's harder to conceptualize radical movement if everything is all full already. And so if you have emptiness, then there's this possibility of really radical change.
That's how back in yourself and deconstructed.
Yeah, that's what
right.
I'm thinking. That's the politics on the air pump, is that you can show that
there's an empty space.
There's a place for you to go.
Yeah.
That's
a much better answer. But there's, I mean, some of this turns back to, I mean, if you look at the kind of historical that issue, right? The sort of history of humanity, chemistry, right? But you're starting with Boyle, actually. And of course, he's the one who's dealing with the air pump, and who's coming to know the air pump, presumably creating this space where it is not. Right? But then there's the whole, the housing and kind of brutal issue that Chafer write about this, and Leviathan and the air pump, but the whole, housing critique of that is, he wasn't ever able to create a vacuum. You can't create a perfect vacuum. It's the whole idea that the air pump leaked. Right, and there's something else getting in there to kill the bird, it was still there because you couldn't. Because back in Holland's thing, you couldn't actually see it. Right? Like, you can't see vacuum, you couldn't see air. There's always this kind of influence.
You see the results of withdrawing the air.
Yeah.
And this causes not only the bird to die, but it causes great emotional distress in little girls.
Right, well, that's part of the imagery.
Can you interpret this distress as a mold of the personal one of sensitive girls? Is this a kind of social distress that might be caused by taking away the natural medium in which we live, which might be something democratic?
Right, that we share.
Or something egalitarian.
Right.
You could, You could actually read it that way. That's really interesting. And particularly the fact that it is women, right? You have these generations of women, right? I mean, it is almost like there's this exploration of, female education, really, going on there, which is, of course, a big part of this, right? You bring women into the education. But also, that idea that to explain the effects of air, right, and thereby know it, and that's the only way you can ever get at air is by looking at its effect. One way of describing its effects is, the dead bird in the vacuum, right, which is actually, the iconography of that is also, just like Father, Son, Holy Spirit, right, I think it's very much configured that way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but, it's really in that triangle, right, so this is our heavy. But it's also another effect of air, right, is the emotional effect on the women watching,
right,
and so why is it that effect, right, doesn't count as much as the effect of the death of either the death of the bird or the death of a whole system of religious meaning.
There's thought about Mater Dolorosa, women standing around mourning.
Oh, no, it's thought of those. It's totally, I have not heard that. I bring it back and you just see so clearly. It's configured exactly.
But you can also see that the man, the scientist, as a kind of modest figure, as a real critique of his sort of supernatural powers.
There is moonlight coming through.
Right.
Inside.
It also has a real, almost a kind of feminist critique of the male domination over the dying bird, over the women suffer and still decide, kind of conflict between science and sensibility.
That's funny.
I think probably we should adjourn. Thanks to the plenitude of ideas and the vexivity of value.
Thank you.
I'm sure Dan would be happy to talk more about all these things.
Yes, I am.